Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from Moask. This week we're talking to mysterious poet Brian Bilston about his upside-down poem, Refugees, and Professor Rochelle Davis about her research into men fleeing conscription in Syria. To commemorate World Poetry Day, Moask spoke to proclaimed poet laureate of Twitter, Brian Bilston, about his influential work, Refugees. The poem has been shared by more than 10,000 people, among them UNHCR's Melissa Fleming. And 24 simple lines were invited to read, reread, and challenge the negative images of refugees. Brian began by telling us what inspired him.
Curiously, the refugee crisis itself wasn't really the starting point for the poem. I'd always been interested in poetic forms, and for a while I'd been wanting to write a poem that you could read in two different ways, inspired by a poem called The Lost Generation by Jonathan Reed. And what was really interesting about that was that you could read it in two different ways and it changed its meaning when read in reverse. I'm usually known for writing rather, well, supposedly humorous verse, and I couldn't really kind of find the right topic to fit with poetic form. So I was kind of struggling this for several months, and meanwhile, I guess the refugee crisis was worsening. There were daily stories in the press, on the news in the evening, on social media, and I think eventually it dawned on me that, particularly when I saw the reaction to some of these tragic, heartbreaking stories that were breaking in the news, the reaction on social media, that the refugee crisis was like a perfect topic for that treatment in that kind of forwards-backwards poetic form.
What is the message or meaning you're trying to convey?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I mean, firstly, it does acknowledge that people respond in different ways, well, to many things, but in this case, the refugee crisis. But also, it's a real call for people to listen to each other and see that there's more than one way of looking at things. My own sympathies very heavily kind of lie, as it were, the reverse of the poem. And I think the structure of the poem makes it more powerful when the words are turned on their head, as it were.
Why do you think it is that poetry lends itself to eliciting empathy or calls to action compared to other forms of literature?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, for one, poems, when well written, have a kind of immediacy that sometimes other forms of literature don't. I think particularly given the length of many poems, there's something, particularly nowadays when people don't have much time, they spend their days looking at their social media feed, which kind of gives them sort of bite-sized nuggets of information and jokes and emotions, etc. The poetry is like a perfect way of kind of consuming that within a kind of social media context. I think particularly things like Twitter kind of really help a poem to come through in a way that a longer piece of writing simply wouldn't.
How has it been received?
Well, incredibly so, and you know, I kind of wrote it and I sent it out there, as I do with many other poems, not really having any idea that it would be any more or less popular than anything else I'd written before. But my Twitter notifications almost instantly went rather crazy. I think within the first couple of days it had been retweeted about 10,000 times, and lots of very high-profile people had read it and forwarded it onto their own followers. So that was rather unusual for a poem to have that kind of big impact. And then it also even got kind of written up in places like The Independent and The Huffington Post. And that was about a year ago. But ever since then, there's been this sort of steady stream of people getting in touch, people wanting to use the poem to make videos of it, being made into a rap. There have been football clubs in Sweden who've recited it at a kind of annual evening with their supporters. All sorts of weird and wonderful uses it's been put to.
Why such a strong reaction, do you think?
I think it's rather a kind of simple poem. You know, the words themselves are simple, straightforward, so that anyone can follow it, can understand it. It's not difficult like some poetry can be. But also I think the conceit of it, the way the whole argument, the whole tone gets turned on its head, people seem to be very taken with that. And it's been one of the things that I've loved about the reception is how children have kind of taken it up. And it's been used a lot in the classroom. It's had a lot of engagement from teenagers. I think it's partly that simplicity, partly the trick, but also that trick of turning it makes the, as it were, the right reading of the words seem even more powerful, I think.
That was Brian Bilston telling us about his poem, Refugees. You can listen to the full poem on the podcast pages below. Now, imagine this. You're male, aged between 18 and 45, and your country is at war with itself. Every day you risk being recruited to fight for a regime you may not even agree with. You'll be attacking people you once called friends and family. There's no way of knowing if or even when you'll be allowed to leave. So what do? Hide at home and take your chances? Or do you escape to somewhere the government can't get you? For Professor Rochelle Davis, hundreds of thousands of Syrian men are fleeing their homes because they refuse to fight, but they don't get the same protections as refugee women and children.
Well, the research that I conducted was just interviewing people who had fled Syria. So we have about 150 interviews with people in Jordan and Lebanon, and then I've done other less formal interviews in Turkey and in Europe and elsewhere. So it was just interviewing people generally with a number of questions, open-ended questions to sort of learn about people's lives, what life had been like before they fled Syria and what their lives were like today. One of the topics that I thought was the most pressing that came out of this was that there were all these men fleeing conscription and nobody was talking about it. I mean, at the time when we did the work back in 2012 and 2013, because I speak Arabic and because I know Syria fairly well, it really struck me that this was a really important topic because people were fleeing because they didn't want to fight. They didn't want to kill other Syrians. They didn't want to be engaged in this. And yet nobody was addressing them as human beings with choices who were choosing not to fight. And instead, the international focus was on women and children, which is great. I mean, women and children need protection too, but so do men. And to me, if men are the ones who are doing the fighting and being forced to fight, and yet you have this huge number, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people who don't want to fight, and yet we're not paying attention to that or listening to them, we're really doing a disservice both to people, but also to, I think we're playing a kind of role in the continuation of this fighting. We should be encouraging people to leave, encouraging particularly men who would be dragged into the fighting to leave. Because if the regime doesn't have people to fill its army, it can't keep this up.
How much of life, employment, and social mobility is actually linked to military service?
Every Syrian carries around a number of documents in addition to their identity card, and Syrian men carry around what they would call daftar jesh, which is the military service card. So for a lot of jobs and government services and all those sorts of things, people had to provide this military card that proved that they had done their military service or that they had an exemption or they were still studying or things like that. So those documents are still important, and if you don't have them, you can't do all sorts of things, including getting government jobs, etc. So there's that very legalistic element of serving in the military. But on a whole other element about social mobility, if you haven't served in the military, you're basically wanted by the Syrian regime. And so you can't really move around the country. You can't move around your city anymore if you're wanted by the regime. And so there is no way for people who haven't done their military service to live a life of any kind. So either I think they have two choices. They maybe have three choices. They stay at home and never leave the house, which is not guaranteed because the Syrian regime will come knocking on doors and come search homes for people. Or they go into the military, or they flee to non-government controlled areas, but that's not particularly a safe place to be because the government bombs those areas. Or they leave the country. And so those are the three choices in front of men who are between the ages of 18, particularly ones who haven't done their military service. And now we're hearing many more cases of men who have finished their military service but are being kept in the reserves, that they can be called up at any time, or their name is on a checkpoint and someone has decided that that they need 10,000 more men, and so they're going to take the first 10,000 that they get who are reservists. They will just be taken too at any time. So there isn't really a way for men in Syria who are of military age to live their lives comfortably unless they have a government job or are of a high enough social class to avoid being taken or to be able to pay bribes. That's the other way that they do it.
You say that there is a stigma or stereotype used to define Syrian men fleeing to neighbouring countries as potential threats or instigators of trouble. How has this stigma developed?
Well, I think this is part of a larger global narrative that has developed around Middle Eastern men and Muslim men. And so they are seen as a threat. They're seen as coercive and backwards and willing to fight, and they're all seen as sort of potential terrorists. So I think that this is this idea that young men in particular who are unanchored from families are much more willing to become extremists and do extreme things. And while statistically that's probably true, it paints them with such a broad brush that it doesn't actually look at the reasons why they fled or the very principled and very difficult decisions they made to leave behind their country, leave behind their families and their loved ones and their friends in order to not participate in violence and in order to not participate in picking up arms and killing other people. One of the things that strikes me is we're very aware of these kinds of nonviolence in many countries in the world, and we're trying to push people towards more nonviolence. And yet these men have chosen not to be violent. They've chosen nonviolence as a path, and yet we don't respect them as individuals for those choices. So it's that kind of stigmatization of them as Middle Easterners and them as Muslim men, and that's what they kind of fall under. The stigma, though, carries into the surrounding countries around it, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, less so Iraq. Iraq actually has many more Syrian men in it than it does Syrian women by 10%. But I think in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, they also see many of them as unanchored to families. They're not with their parents or brothers and sisters and things. And so that also is sort of dangerous. They see them as not anchored to society and not tied to society.
Has your research achieved its objective?
There's a mixed answer to that. And in some cases, I think there has been, certainly in Europe, a move to not immediately throw young men out because they are young men. Syrians who are fleeing the conflict have been allowed to stay. Syrian young men who are fleeing conflict have been allowed to stay. But it's not because they are young men, it's because they are Syrians. So I think that in that sense, the issues that they face have not really been addressed, and I don't think they've been addressed around the globe. I just don't think there's been an awareness that forced conscription is a reason why people flee, and instead they get just seen as their demographic, as young men or men. And so, no, I mean, I guess the ultimate answer is no. I don't think it's been taken into consideration or addressed in a way. There's still very little programming for men in the international communities, areas where they deal with refugees. There are a few areas where they target young men for interventions, but they're still by far the least served community among the refugees.
That was Professor Rochelle Davis of Georgetown University telling us about Syrian men fleeing conscription and how we should extend humanitarian protections to them. You can listen to the full interview in the links below. Next time on the MOAS podcast, we'll be looking at the highlights of MOAS Exchange 2.0. Until then, you can follow us on our social media and check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and now Audioboom. Or support our rescue missions by giving whatever you can to help us save lives at sea. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.